KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Kentucky braces for a winter storm just days after deadly flooding killed at least 11 people across the Commonwealth. We hear from Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. The crackdown on immigration has stirred fear amid mixed status families. I'm Layla Faldig.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We speak with a mother who's preparing for the possibility of deportation by making sure someone will be able to look after her children. Also, we hear from the Battle of Iwo Jima and what's it like to drop your debut album at 78. We ask Rusty Williams, who just did it with the help of his famous granddaughter. It's Tuesday, February 18th. Happy birthday to the man who's still D-R-E. Andre Young, better known as Dr. Dre, turned 60 years old today.
Can't stop rhyming.
News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and his Russian counterpart have concluded talks in Saudi Arabia. They focused on ending the war in Ukraine 3 years after Russia invaded. Rubio says ending the war will require concessions on all sides. White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz says that means there'll have to be meaningful negotiations.
Some underlying principles. This needs to be a permanent end to the war. And not a temporary end as we've seen in the past. We know just the practical reality is that there is going to be some discussion of territory, and there's going to be discussion of security guarantees.
But the U.S. and Russia excluded Ukraine from today's talks. They also excluded European leaders. The Trump administration has essentially agreed to Russian demands. The U.S. won't back NATO membership for Ukraine and says Ukraine won't be able to get back all its territory. Lebanese troops have regained control over nearly a dozen areas in southern Lebanon. Israeli forces were supposed to withdraw from there under ceasefire terms, ending the war with Hezbollah. But NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports Israel is keeping some of its forces based in Lebanon.
The Lebanese military said it has moved into 11 locations in southern Lebanon where the Israeli military has withdrawn from. It said it was surveying the damage done by the war. It said it was coordinating with United Nations peacekeepers. But on Monday, Israel said it will remain in 5 locations in southern Lebanon to protect communities in the north of Israel. Lebanese officials and Hezbollah said this violates the terms of the ceasefire, calling for Israel to withdraw completely. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun said that the ceasefire agreement, quote, must be respected and that Israel cannot be trusted. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she'll meet with key leaders in New York City today. They'll weigh the possible ouster of Democratic Mayor Eric Adams. 4 top aides to Adams resigned yesterday. NPR's Brian Mann reports there is a growing scandal involving corruption charges against the mayor.
In a statement, Hochul said she spoke with Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer, one of Adams' 4 top aides leaving office. According to Hochul, that conversation left her with, quote, serious questions about the long-term future of this mayoral administration. Mayor Adams was charged by the Justice Department in September with bribery and corruption. Critics say the Trump administration shelved those charges only after Adams agreed to help a national crackdown on migrants. No governor in the last 235 years has used their authority to oust an elected mayor of New York City, but Hochul said the crisis in City Hall is troubling and cannot be ignored. Adams has denied any wrongdoing and says he won't resign. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Senate is scheduled to hold a confirmation vote this afternoon for Howard Lutnick to be the next Commerce Secretary. Lutnick is a billionaire investor who's been a Wall Street CEO for many years. He led President Trump's transition team and strongly backs Trump's moves to impose more tariffs. After the Eaton fire broke out in Los Angeles, it was not fully contained for more than 3 weeks. NPR's investigations team transcribed hours of first responder radio to better understand how the power company was involved. NPR's Kiara Eisner has more.
When high winds and dry conditions whip up a wildfire, power lines can cause problems by sparking or falling down. That's dangerous for first responders and can also start new fires. NPR analyzed almost 100 hours of radio traffic exchanged among firefighters responding to the Eaton fire.
They did
Delta Branch 3. Hey, I just met with Edison's reps. They're not going to be able to guarantee shutdown in here.
That evidence shows the power company, Southern California Edison, wasn't able to quickly shut off power in two key neighborhoods, and that live power lines led to new fires. The Eaton fire burned down about 10,000 structures and led to the deaths of 17 people. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
Officials at the Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut are caring for a baby gray seal. It was discovered twice over the weekend in New Haven, wandering the streets. Aquarium officials in Mystic say the baby seal is only a few weeks old and likely got disoriented in New Haven. They plan to eventually put him back into the ocean. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we'll ask Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear about how his state is enduring the devastation brought by weekend storms and floods.
But first, a look at the Trump administration's actions so far on the world stage. Critics say that his actions, including upending years of U.S. diplomacy that sought to isolate Russia or pushing for a plan to displace all Palestinians in Gaza and turn it into seaside real estate, are ushering in a new world order. To talk about Trump's foreign policy, we're joined by Richard Haass. He is president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations think tank and also served as director of policy planning in former President George W. Bush's first term. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
So when people say Trump is ushering in a new world order, does that mean the shattering of the post-World War II alliances and institutions of the so-called free world, the UN, international courts, and the like?
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, think about the world order he inherited. It wasn't perfect, but it was rules-based, above all, a respect for sovereignty. Territory ought not to be acquired by force. There were rules governing trade and investment, rules protecting human rights, and at least in principle, every country was to be treated with equality. And I think what we're beginning to see, and it's hard to be too absolute about it because the administration's, what, barely, you know, a month old, not even.
Yeah.
But we're seeing a world in which great powers, including the United States, have special rights. They have special rights to decide the fate of others. They have the ability, in some cases, to take or what it is they want. And what this could be, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but if the United States is clearly asserting this in the Western Hemisphere, think about the Panama Canal, Canada, Mexico, Greenland, what have you. And then you have, we'll see what happens with the talks with Russia, but there seems to be a willingness to give Russia a greater hand in Europe. We don't have any clear indications yet about China in the Asia Pacific, But clearly we are moving away from the world where the United States, in tandem with its allies of 75, 80 years in many cases, would work together in terms of building all sorts of organizations and principles to govern international relations.
You know, there will be some who are listening to you and will say so much about the current global order just wasn't working. Ukraine has not been able to repel Russia despite all of this European and U.S. help. The Middle East is in this fluid, unstable place. Is the Trump approach of transactional diplomacy and, as you said, special rights a new way forward?
Well, it may be, but I'd say two things about that. One is I wouldn't be so quick to jettison the old world. Last I checked, we avoided great power war for 80 years. The Cold War stayed cold, ended peacefully, and on terms consistent with American interests and values. The United States has become extraordinarily prosperous, as have many others. People live longer around the world. More people live with degrees of freedom and democracy than any other time in human history. So however imperfect this world is, not bad. Even the case you mentioned about Ukraine. Sure, Russian aggression against Ukraine was a violation, but so far, at least, the Russians haven't gotten away with it. Last I checked, Ukraine still controls roughly 80% of its territory and continues to be a viable nation state. So one can point out the imperfections, but the imperfections stem not from the rules, but from at times our unwillingness to observe them.
Now, Trump also seems unfazed about upsetting traditional allies. The U.S. strongest allies in Europe are getting upset over the Trump administration's approach to the continent. Vice President J.D. Vance lecturing them on their domestic affairs, as some leaders have put it. The Trump administration's embrace of far-right actors in Europe. They also feel isolated in the U.S.-Russia talks on Ukraine, sidelined, which they view this issue as the continent's biggest security threat. If the U.S. alienates European allies, what then?
Well, I would think it's a big mistake. The great comparative advantage of the United States vis-a-vis both Russia and China is we get up every morning and we have this enormous pool of allies who are willing to work with us, whether it's to deal with the geopolitical challenges of the day or global health issues or economic issues, whatever. What's so interesting about the Trump foreign policy is allies are not seen as different or special. They're treated just like everybody else, in some cases worse than everybody else, because they're involved with us economically. We have more means to penalize them. Or we're having these talks with Russia going over the heads of our allies. We're going over the head, to some extent, of Ukraine. So I would think this is a world in which we end up with less influence, potentially with less order, and quite possibly some of these allies will begin to diversify almost their portfolios. Rather than depending on us, some of them may say we need nuclear weapons of our own, or we're just going to disregard what it is Washington says because Washington now has become so unpredictable and self-interested. So we're moving towards a much less American-centric world.
Richard Haass is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the weekly Substack newsletter Home and Away. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to check in now on Kentucky, which is bracing for a winter storm. This comes after weekend floods killed at least 12 people and displaced hundreds more. Thousands, though, remain without power and water. Stan Ingold of member station WEKU has been following the aftermath.
Floods range from the Mississippi River in the west to the Appalachian Mountains in the east.
This is so much broader than past natural disasters.
That is Eastern Kentucky native Rocky Adkins. He is senior advisor to Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. He says some rivers still have not crested. This flood impacted the entire state and brought back memories of tornadoes in 2021 that killed 80 and the 2022 floods that killed 45. Adkins says that's a lot to endure.
Man, we've been punched too much. We've had our guts knocked out. We take a right cross and then an uppercut and then we get hit in the gut again. But I'm going to tell you about our people. Man, they get knocked down, they crawl right back up.
One of the hardest hit areas is Pike County, Kentucky, where at least three people died. Ray Jones is the county judge executive.
We do think that there are potentially additional fatalities. We don't know that.
Rescue teams continue to search for some people who are missing. Jones says that there's also a lot of work ahead.
And we have hundreds of structures, both business and residential, that have been damaged, and a lot of the individuals who have been harmed by this flood have been also damaged in recent floods.
It's expected to take a while to assess all of the damage. And there's more severe weather this week. A winter storm is forecast for tonight. Officials say it could make things even more difficult for crews working to clear roads and restore water and power. For NPR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Richmond, Kentucky.
Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear joins us now from Kentucky's capital, Frankfort. Governor, have you been out there surveying the damage so far? What have you seen?
I have. We've been hit again, and we've been hit hard. We've lost 12 Kentuckians, each a child of God, missed by their communities and their families today, and we're mourning with those families. I was in Pike County yesterday, seeing homes and businesses that have just been destroyed, several feet of mud, everything inside just wiped away. Folks that didn't have a lot to begin with, losing what they had. Then we've got about 150 people in one of our state parks where the water's so bad, they actually can't get in and out of the state park, but thankfully we're taking care of them. So it took me going through a large National Guard truck, a pontoon boat, but we made it out to them to make sure they knew that we've got everything they need until that water recedes. But it's a full statewide disaster, flooding and damage from our Mississippi River all the way through the Appalachian Mountains.
Well, the kind of flooding that Kentucky tends to get, I mean, you just have to try and wait it out until the sun comes out and the water dries up, or can you do anything now?
Well, I'd say this flooding is historic, but we had it in 2022 and 2021. So the flash flooding is past that on Saturday and was very dangerous, but now our rivers are flooding, and what will happen is one community will flood, that river will crest, and then it moves further down, and another one will flood. So we are digging out, and we're mucking out, but this is going to be a long-term effort, and we're going to need a lot of help. Help here in Kentucky, help from our federal government, and help from generous people across the country.
So speaking of the federal government, President Trump authorized federal disaster assistance from FEMA. What do your constituents need the most in terms of assistance right now?
Well, I'm grateful to Secretary Noem and President Trump. They turned around that disaster declaration very quickly. FEMA has surged resources for the search and rescue phase that we are still in, even though we're on day four. But what we're going to need from the federal government is approval for individual assistance that will provide some dollars for this emergency phase, for cleaning up. But then that's up to $42,000 to help people get back on their feet. And we're going to need that system to run smoother than it has in the past. But FEMA is here with us. They are working with us, and we're grateful that they're here and for the support of the administration.
You got some winter weather headed your way, Governor. How worried are you?
Very. We got about an inch this morning, which we did not expect, and we've got anywhere from 2 to 8 inches that are going to hit across the state. We've already been out there doing boat rescues in the middle of snowstorms, and this is going to further complicate it. We've got over 340 just state and federal roads that have mudslides or other issues with them, and now we're going to add that snow on top of it. But we're tough people. We know how to get through things and get through them together, but we could certainly use support, whether that's our Team Kentucky Storm Relief Fund for those that can help people get back on their feet. And we're grateful for all the teams that have come in from other states like Indiana and West Virginia that are helping us out.
Governor, you got about 20 seconds if you want to send a message to your fellow Kentuckians today.
Well, to everybody in Kentucky, we're here with you today. We'll be here with you tomorrow. We've been hit hard, but we will get back up. We will march forward. We'll get through this. We'll get through this together, just like we always do. Good neighbors helping other neighbors, people of great values, and we'll make it.
That's Kentucky's Governor Andy Beshear. Thank you very much, Governor.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, 25 years ago, measles was declared eliminated in the United States. Today, measles is back, and infectious disease specialist Dr. Adam Ratner has written a new book that makes the case that the resurgence is a warning of an uncertain future for children's health. His book is called Booster Shots. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the estate of Joan B. Kruk, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Tomorrow marks the 80th anniversary of the start of one of the most ferocious battles of World War II, the Battle of Iwo Jima. Tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers invaded a strategically critical island held by Japan, and their movements were documented by Marine Corps war correspondents on the front lines.
An American dive bombing attack is taking place just ahead of us on the Japanese who are holed up in the northern edges of the island.
That's one of the voices from 1945 preserved at the Library of Congress in a collection called the U.S. Marine Corps Combat Recordings. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
Some of these Iwo Jima recordings are so vivid, so immediate, the war sounds like it's playing out inside your head. So, a warning. You can clearly hear battlefield bombing in the very next clip.
Now an American plane is diving straight on the Japanese positions. Now it's coming up out of it.
War correspondent Staff Sergeant Alvin Josephy Jr. is often heard in the hundreds of recordings in this collection, keeping cool even in mortal danger.
We were sniped at a couple of moments ago by snipers who are across an open clearing.
Hearing someone's voice talking about what's going on around them makes history living.
That's archivist Patrick Mittling. He runs the recorded sound section at the National Audiovisual Conservation Center that's part of the Library of Congress. Mittling says what impresses him most about Staff Sergeant Alvin Josephy Jr. is his equanimity.
There is this kind of like matter-of-fact way in which he's talking about what's going on around him, and I think that's just really cool.
Well, that's the way it is here on Iwo Jima.
This collection of around 1,500 recordings also includes interviews with infantrymen who were the first to slog on shore.
When did you come ashore on Iwo? I came ashore at D plus one. In the afternoon, it was plenty wet, too.
It was plenty hot, too, wasn't it?
It was plenty hot.
And church services?
So far away.
Held during a bloody campaign that killed more than 6,000 Americans and 22,000 Japanese. One part of the collection that surprised Matthew Barton, the sound curator at the Library of Congress, were the recordings made by Marines of indigenous people making music in the Pacific Islands. That recording was made by a young Pete Seeger. Yes, future folk star Pete Seeger.
He was in the service, and he was in the Pacific, so there you go.
These soldiers holding the microphones knew they were making history, says archivist Patrick Mittling. He says to hear what they heard gives us immediate access into their long-ago lives.
Those are the stories that help provide the history of what's important for us to remember. There are facts in textbooks, but all of these things happen to people.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Rusty Williams is not famous. Perhaps if things had happened differently, he could have been. He's a singer who wanted to make it in the music business, and now at 78, his famous granddaughter is helping his dream come true. NPR's Milton Gibada has a story.
Rusty Williams has been making music since he was seven.
I wanted to sing, and that's what I did.
Beginning in the early 70s, Williams and his producer friend Frank Morris got in the studio to record some of the songs they wrote.
He's a riverboat gambler and he knows what to play. When the cards fall wrong, there'll be another day. If he don't win a hand, he'll take what he can. Take what he can.
When Williams presented those recordings to bigwigs in Nashville, he was told to change them.
Go home and make them country. I said, I am not country, don't want to be country.
So Williams stood his ground and refused to release the would-be album. The tapes were shelved, and as time passed...
I had forgotten about them.
Although he let the recordings collect dust, he never forgot about the music.
I had heard him play some of those songs on the piano when I was really, really young.
That's his granddaughter, Haley. Those songs lit a fire.
And when she started talking about, she said, Granddad, how'd I get in the music business? I said, baby, you gotta want it.
She did want it. While Rusty never became the big-time singer in the family, Haley Williams did. She's the lead singer of Paramore, a rock band that has toured the world many times over. It wasn't until recently that she realized her grandfather almost had an album of his own. Rusty's producer friend had dug up the old recordings and sent them to the family.
I think they were moving houses, or they were doing something and going through a bunch of old stuff, and somehow it just came up that Granddad really wanted to have all of this music and be able to listen to it just for himself.
And Haley's bandmate in Paramore, Zach Farrow, happens to run a record label. When he heard Rusty's music...
he was like, this is incredible. Like, we need to do something with this, you know? And the next thing I knew, we had everything digitized. Won't you tell me now, so I'm knocking, only knocking at your door. And while your heart is aching, your mind is breaking, for you won't let me in. No, you won't let me in anymore. I probably hang out with Gran and Granddad more than anyone else in my life. And I hear stories all the time, but when you get to actually experience a piece of that history and it gets brought into the present with you, that's just like better than a photo album. It's like you're sitting there with all of it in the moment.
Some of the moments in the music capture Rusty's love for Sharon, his wife of 60 years.
What's your favorite one, Granddad, if you had to pick?
Every Time I'm High.
Oh, I love that song.
Every time I'm high.
Oh, Granddad cries pretty easy these days.
Better late than never. At 78, Rusty Williams finally released his debut album. It's called Grandman. Milton Gavada, NPR News.
Granddad, you did your first NPR interview.
I did, and that made me famous. And now that I've found.
This is NPR News.
A Syrian soccer player became the voice of the country's revolution with his iconic protest anthems. He was killed in 2019, but the man who wrote his songs still lives. I'm Elsa Chang, the singer and the songwriter who scored a revolution. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine will require concessions from all sides. Rubio was speaking to reporters in Saudi Arabia today following several hours of talks with a delegation from Moscow. The Russian side was led by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The meeting followed last week's 90-minute phone call between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Here's Rubio expanding on the talks in Riyadh.
In order for a conflict to end, everyone involved in that conflict has to be okay with it. It has to be acceptable to them. But we have to understand that it's been 3.5 years since there's been any sort of regularized contact between the United States and Russia, and in some cases between any of the participants in this conflict and Russia. So the goal of today's meeting was to follow up on the phone call the president had a week ago and begin to establish those lines of communication.
No date has been set for a summit between Trump and Putin. Hamas says it will release the final 6 living Israeli hostages to be freed as part of the first phase of the Israel-Hamas ceasefire agreement. Among those to be released on Saturday are 2 Israelis who've been held by Hamas for about a decade. Hamas says it will hand over the bodies of 4 hostages on Thursday. This is NPR News. The National Transportation Safety Board will be assisting investigators in Canada to determine why a Delta Airlines plane flipped over yesterday as it was landing in Toronto. 18 of the 80 people aboard that flight were injured. The commuter plane was arriving from Minneapolis at Pearson International Airport amid blowing snow and strong winds. Those winds were gusting up to 40 miles per hour at the time. Southwest Airlines says it's laying off 15% of its workforce. Caroline Love, with member station KERA in Dallas, says hundreds of jobs are being eliminated to cut costs.
The layoffs affect more than 1,700 employees. CEO Robert Jordan said in a statement it was a difficult and monumental decision. The airline has faced challenges in recent months, including declining profit margins and a civil lawsuit over alleged mismanagement of an employee retirement plan. Southwest also restructured its board in October as part of a settlement with an investment firm that tried to oust Jordan, but he refused to resign. The airline announced several changes last fall to boost revenue, including the end of its open seating policy next year. Eligible employees impacted by the layoffs will receive salary and benefits through late April. For NPR News, I'm Caroline Love in Dallas.
In early trading on Wall Street, the Dow is down 102 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington. President Trump made a bold promise on the campaign trail, mass deportations. Now his administration is releasing images of immigrants being perp-walked in the streets and loaded on military planes. The administration says its focus is criminals, and Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, is a regular on news shows talking about the deportations. Here he is on Fox News.
When we find the bad guy, he's probably with others. Others that are in the United States illegally. They may not be a criminal priority, but we're not walking away from them.
Now, many Americans are supportive of stricter immigration restrictions, but they're divided on the harsher measures Trump has enacted. And the sweeping crackdown has created an atmosphere of fear in communities with mixed-status families. It's pervasive even in places where there haven't been these splashy immigration raids, like Hyattsville, Maryland, a 20-minute drive or so from D.C. It's home to the St. Matthew's Episcopal Church that holds services in both Spanish and English for a diverse congregation with North American, African, Caribbean, and Central and South American backgrounds. On the day we visit, the church is having its monthly food drive. At the door, flyers say, "I will protect and fight for DACA, immigrants, and refugees." They sit next to a box filled with loaves of bread. Volunteers are breaking down the empty food boxes and filling bags with groceries. Everyone is welcome if they are in need. Lorena Sanchez is one of the volunteers.
She's opening each bag with onions, beans, rice.
They serve over 200 families every month. But these days, some who are undocumented are too afraid to leave their homes and pick up the food.
We've had to deliver these bags to people because they don't feel comfortable or safe leaving their homes.
Earlier in the same hall, we sat down with a woman who didn't want to use her full name because of the fear that percolates here.
My name is Anna. I don't speak English too much.
Anna's wearing a t-shirt that says, "Blessed Grandma," and her four-year-old grandson's head is cradled in her lap. She's been in the U.S. for 21 years. She has three American children and an American grandchild, and she and her husband are the family breadwinners. The deacon of the church, Sally Ethelson, interprets.
We come here because we want to have a better life. We want to advance the lives of our children. We don't want to hurt or do any harm to anyone.
Anna, her husband, and her oldest daughter came from El Salvador fleeing violence.
Mi hijo.
And what most concerns Anna, of course, is the younger child, because if there were some kind of a separation, it would be very difficult for them as parents, but also for the child. It's very difficult to give custody or to think about giving custody to someone else. It's not easy to sign a document that would do that. However, I understand that the standby guardianship tool is something that can be used if they were deported. But again, it's not easy to sign such a document.
Anna's youngest child is only 7. Maryland has long had a law for parents to choose a standby guardian in case they were physically or mentally incapacitated. When families were being separated under the last Trump administration, immigrant advocates fought to expand that law to include immigrants who may find themselves suddenly detained or deported. So did you sign this document?
Sí.
We felt that something that we needed to do, and for anyone who is undocumented, this is just a very, very difficult situation, and we are really living in fear. And we tried to explain and go through this with the kids, but the youngest one, of course, doesn't really understand. They can't really process the information. And of course, the decision still remains is if something did happen, would they then make a decision to have the child stay here in the United States more permanently, or would they have that standby guardian actually ensure that the child made its way back to El Salvador with the parents?
You know, this administration says, well, if people are here without documents, they shouldn't be here.
You know, in our countries, there's really no future. There's no work. We come here, and the work that we do, you know, we're able to survive. What people need to understand is that we do the most difficult and heavy, weighty type of work. And without documents, it's true that sometimes we're discriminated against.
How has your life changed in the last few weeks since ICE raids began?
El impacto ha sido grande.
It's had a massive effect on me because, you know, I just can't go out the same way I used to. I used to go out whenever I wanted, and it's had an impact on my health. So, for example, she gives a list to her second daughter, her 18-year-old daughter, for her to actually go to the store. She gives her a list, and her daughter goes to the grocery store and buys everything that's actually needed. She is too scared to actually do that.
And it's impacted your health?
Hay noches que yo no puedo dormir.
There are nights when I can't sleep. I've never really suffered from migraines or headaches, but literally I wake up every morning and I have a headache and my head is just hurting all the time. I pray every day. I have a lot of faith and I try not to be too worried, but I can't avoid it.
Anna does seasonal work remotely so she can care for the children. Her husband is in construction, but he's downsized to smaller projects, she says, afraid a big crew would attract the attention of immigration agents. They work, and she says neither have ever committed a crime. The senior priest at this church, Father Vidal Rivas, says he's making sure people in his community know their rights, like Anna, and that includes the Standby Guardianship Program.
We as a church, we encourage our members to do something that will protect them and safeguard their children. We don't ask them about their status. Instead, we invite them to fill out these forms because we know that the president can, with a stroke of the pen, actually remove people's status, whether it's TPS or anything else. And so we ask them, when they do fill out these forms, to make sure that they choose people who either have permanent residence or citizenship.
I mean, is it dozens of people at your church that are doing this?
No. So we really don't keep data on this. It is many people. You know, we're having 5 to 7 families every week, but we try not to actually kind of keep track of all of this. I've been in this country for 27 years, and we've never done this before, and I've never seen a situation similar to this in terms of this new administration. You know, our people are full of fear. They're not sleeping at night. They're moving from place to place every day. The sense of persecution is real, and I might use the word terror. People are feeling terrorized. People are being terrorized.
The priest has already signed on to be the standby guardian for 15 kids. The parents had no one else they trusted. Rives says if the worst happens and he needs to care for them, he knows it will change his life. But he's following his Christian faith. Treat your neighbor as you would yourself. This is NPR News. Study shows some people are so addicted to cannabis they can't stop despite being ill, even facing death. One problem, the drug's potency. That's next time, here and now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, Martinez. Someone spent nearly $2 million on a license plate this week. Not a car, just the plate. Hong Kong's transportation department auctions off interesting plates every Lunar New Year. The big winner this year was S, just S. Short plates like that are really desirable, but this one reportedly got an extra boost because it's basically the Superman logo. Although, to be clear, that is not an S, but the Kryptonian symbol for hope. I know, giving myself a nerd alert. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Men do not live as long as women. Life expectancy for an American man is almost 76, compared with 81 for a woman. Deaths among both older and younger men contribute to those numbers, so would greater attention to men's health make a difference? Ashley Milne-Tight has this report.
Some of you may be thinking, hang on, women's health has been sidelined for years. Right up until the last few decades, most clinical studies were carried out on men. Derek Griffith knows that. He's a professor of health equity and population health at the University of Pennsylvania. Still, he says,
it's not a zero-sum game. We can promote women's equality, equity, opportunities while actually focusing on the health and well-being of men.
Griffith is alarmed that the longevity gap between men and women in the U.S. has widened in the last couple of decades. He says more research is needed into why. Of the 15 leading causes of death, from cancer and heart disease to accidents and suicide, he says men fare worse in nearly all of them, and they're not the only ones affected.
If men struggle in terms of their health, their well-being, and so forth, that tends to put not just a burden on those men, but on the women in their lives.
So he says for everyone's sake, there should be more emphasis nationally on the factors that affect men's physical and mental health. There are some men's health centers in the U.S., although several focus solely on sexual health. The Preston Robert Tisch Center for Men's Health in New York City offers comprehensive care. Dr. Stephen Lamb directs the center. He says they aim to make things convenient for men who generally don't want to spend a lot of time at the doctor.
Patient has a knee sprain, get the x-ray right here. You think that they may have a clot in their leg, get the ultrasound.
He says traditionally men haven't gone to the doctor as often as women.
You know, they were always told to suck it up. And so unfortunately, rather than seeking preventive care, they waited until something was broken.
Today, he's seeing more young men for checkups than he ever has, which gives him hope for their future health. Still, he says, for many guys under economic stress,
their health is not their priority. They don't have time to take care of themselves. They're not going to address their weight. They're just struggling to pay the bills.
And for a lot of men, thinking about their health, especially if something's wrong, is uncomfortable. Jack Rayner of Tryon, North Carolina, is 70 now, but says when he was young,
I read Superman comic books. And we learned how the Man of Steel could do all things. And so that is, in many ways, how I learned psychologically about what it meant to be masculine.
He was shocked to discover a couple of years ago that he had an aggressive form of prostate cancer. Part of the treatment involved removing testosterone from his body, and the effects caught him off guard.
Removal of the sense of masculinity left me without what I called gumption.
He felt vulnerable in a way he never had before. A widower, Rayner says friends helped him get through the treatment. Today, he's cancer-free, but he says he has to accept that he's not as vibrant as he was at 40, and that's hard.
I am very much in the process of considering what it means to be 70, reasonably healthy, and how I want to be living into the next iteration of the journey.
He says being at this stage of life feels like stepping into the unknown. For NPR News, I'm Ashley Milne-Tight.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We've seen ample evidence of the human suffering caused by flooding and wildfires in places like California and Florida, the emotional trauma and the financial devastation. But Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell told the Senate Banking Committee recently that an exodus of banks and insurers could make it even worse.
You know, if you fast forward 10 or 15 years, there are going to be regions of the country where you can't get a mortgage, there won't be ATMs, there won't, you know, the banks won't have branches and things like that.
Is he right? We're going to get additional perspective on this from Ben Keyes. He is a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Keyes, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let me start with insurance in places like Los Angeles, which has just experienced these terrible wildfires, or coastal Florida. I think most people know that insurance premiums have skyrocketed in many places, especially places like that. Insurers are pulling out of some places that are considered at climate risk. Is this at a level that you would consider a crisis?
It is a crisis for many homeowners. It's difficult to find private insurers who are willing to write policies in many of these areas. My research has shown that premiums have risen by more than 50% in some of the highest risk zip codes in the country since the start of COVID. So this is a real challenge for homeowners, and it's becoming a difficulty when it comes to their pocketbooks.
So what does this have to do with our ability to get a mortgage?
Yeah, well, in order to get a mortgage, you basically have to have an insurance policy attached to it. Most mortgages are sold by lenders and then securitized into a mortgage-backed security system, and for the mortgage to make its way through that chain, it effectively needs to be bubble-wrapped with an insurance policy that's going to protect the holders of that risk. And so you really can't get a mortgage without an insurance policy. And taking it one step further, it's really difficult to buy a house without a mortgage.
In Florida, even before Hurricanes Helene and Milton last year, some homeowners had just one option. This is the state-backed nonprofit Citizens Property Insurance, an insurer of last resort, you know, as it were. And then California had an insurer of last resort, which just ran out of money. It was bailed out. But is it just likely then that the federal government is going to step in these places?
I think at the moment we have a system of 50 state regulators that are regulating the insurance market in a very fragmented and inconsistent way. And most states now have created their own insurers of last resort as a band-aid on a system that is now far overstretched.
So that's what's so interesting about this, because the mortgage market in the United States is dominated by these government-backed entities, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the FHA, right? And then I guess the VA too. So given that the federal government already plays such a big role in mortgage finance and mortgage credit, does the direction seem to be moving that the federal government would then have to be involved in insurance as well? And what's interesting about this is that there's a move to privatize these entities.
You've put your finger on the big question at the moment, is how do we reconcile state-level regulation of insurance and the enormous federal role in the mortgage market? The beneficiaries of insurance are so dominantly these federal entities at the moment. The other tension is insurance policies are just for 1 year, but the mortgages that those entities you mentioned are insuring or guaranteeing last for 30 years. And so reconciling those two things becomes a big challenge when one of those two entities is especially stressed.
The Fed chair was clearly sounding the alarm, but what is he sounding the alarm about? What would you say?
Well, I think he's raising the profile of climate risk. I think as we're looking at the upcoming years, there is going to be a large push to privatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the ways in which those entities think about pricing climate risk is going to be a major question on the table. I think more generally, he's raising a big red flag going forward that we need to think much more carefully about where we live, where we build, and how we invest in infrastructure and the built environment in the face of rising climate change.
That's Ben Keyes. He's professor of real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Professor Keyes, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
More people are looking for help managing gambling addiction. That's a finding from a new study into the impact of a Supreme Court decision that eased restrictions on online sports betting. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
The idea for this study, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, came to John Ayers after a conversation he had while he was golfing.
And one of the cart boys comes up to me and asks me to borrow money.
He wondered how this young man didn't have some cash around, given he was the recipient of lots of tips that Ayers himself had given him.
And I'm asking him, and he's like, oh, I really missed out on, but I've had a bunch of bad breaks lately on my bets.
In 2018, the Supreme Court allowed states to significantly expand online betting platforms. Ayers works for the University of California, San Diego. For this study, he and his colleagues looked at search terms that indicated people were struggling with gambling addiction.
They're writing, they're typing onto Google, like, am I addicted to gambling? Help me find help with gambling addiction, etc. And we see that those searches nationally increased about 23% since the Supreme Court case legalized sports books.
They could see that these kinds of search terms increased in states immediately after they opened sports betting. And they found that the impact was significantly greater than the opening of brick-and-mortar gambling establishments. Ayers says gambling addiction is a public health and mental health issue.
Gambling disorder is a clinical diagnosis. And you start looking into the potential health implications, and you see we have a complete blind spot to this.
Industry groups argue otherwise. Joe Maloney is with the American Gaming Association, representing casino and online gambling companies.
It's important to remember that the vast majority of gamblers enjoy gambling, all forms of casino gaming, responsibly, and that includes sports betting.
He argues that legalizing online sports betting allows for its regulation and services to help people who are struggling.
And to the extent that there are those that are demonstrating problematic behavior, right now, this activity being out in the light, not in the shadows, is enabling services to be delivered.
Total sports wagers across the country in 2023, according to this report, were over $120 billion. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.